Who are your musical influences?
To be honest with you, they're all over the map. My early influences were actually my mother and really dorky people like the Carpenters and the Monkees. And, you know, I listened to a lot of musicals and Broadway stuff because that's what my mother was into. And I also grew up on listening to her sing a lot of tunes from the 30s, 40s, and early 50s, sort of old standards and stuff. So that was sort of the early stuff. And in high school, I was definitely a choral person. I sang a lot myself, sang in choirs and stuff. And even into college, it was more classical than anything. But the people I did listen to once I got out of the house and started discovering my own tastes were a combination of, I always loved all of the sort of old soul divas and R&B divas, the Arethas and the Chaka Khans and Barbra Streisand and all the great sort of divas, you know, Bette Midler and those people. Those were sort of my early icons when I came out. But as far as creatively, it probably has more to do with show tunes, Sondheim, that kind of thing, and earlier writers for the theater. And I think you can tell that in some of my contributions to the Romanowski and Phillips songbook, as it were, because I definitely have that sort of pop show mentality.
I know you've told this story. You guys told it in the This Way Out interview, but it's a great story about how you two met.
Oh, boy. The way we met. The way we were. It was a nice day, a pleasant day in San Francisco. I was walking in Golden Gate Park, and I was actually done walking in the park, ready to move on and get the bus to go home. And I was walking just the last little strip of road when across the road comes this boy on a bicycle, and he got off his bicycle right in front of me, basically, and sat down under a tree. And I thought he was really cute, but I kept walking because I just thought, well, I wasn't sure what was going on, you know. I guess we sort of cruised, but he looked so young that I thought he was jailbait, and I wasn't really interested in something like that. But I kept looking back, and he kept looking at me. So it was definitely that there was a cruise thing going on there, I guess. Our eyes were meeting. But I kept walking because I just kept thinking in my head, no, these things don't ever work out, you know. I'd be foolish to think that it's worth the time to stop and try and have a conversation or something, you know. It just didn't seem like something that usually happens. It was a little too magical. So I kept walking, and I got to the bus stop, and unbeknownst to me, he had gotten on his bike and pedaled to the gas station on the corner right across from the bus stop, and on the pretext of filling his tires with air, but I didn't even know he was over there because I had lost track of him. So just as the bus came, I all of a sudden see him coming down the street, coasting down the sidewalk on his bike. And I just, again, couldn't figure out what to do. You know, it was kind of one of those moments where, oh, do I stop and play this silly game, or do I just get on with my life, you know? So, long story shorter, a little shorter, I went ahead and got on the bus, and as the bus pulled away, I'm walking towards the back of the bus, and I see him pedaling behind the bus. And I started smiling, and I'm sure that there were people on the bus who probably even figured out what was going on, but I just thought that was really cute. And so I got off at the next stop, and again he came ghosting up to me on his bike and said, and I swear to you, it's the honest to God truth, the first words out of his mouth were, that was only a block, couldn't you have walked?
So what led up to, obviously you started dating and seeing each other, what led up to you performing together?
Ron had already been writing songs, and to be honest with you, I wasn't that impressed with them. They were fairly simplistic songs, very angst-ridden about stuff that he's gone through in his life as a youngster in high school and stuff, you know, and he was trying to write more poetic stuff, but I just wasn't that impressed with the songs that he had written until he wrote a song called Lost Emotions, and the minute he sang it to me, I told him, wait, listen, I want to harmonize with it, and I did, and that was kind of the beginning. Because he fell in love with the sound of our two voices. I fell in love with his songwriting ability, finally. And so I started performing one or two songs with him. He was doing, like, open mics, and he would have various people perform with him. A friend of his played violin, and sometimes his friend who played the violin would play on a song or two. And, you know, he had a little repertoire of songs. And I would just come up and sing on one or two songs, sing some harmonies. And I'm not even sure exactly when the change happened, but I know that we went to the Valencia Rose. We heard this club was opening called the Valencia Rose, and we went and auditioned for the owner, and they were going to have an open mic gay comedy night. And the guy said, okay, well, why don't you come and do a couple of songs and be the musical break for the gay comedy night open mic. And, to be honest with you, we've always said this, but I think he felt sorry for us. I just think he couldn't say no to two little adorable waifs like we seemed at that point. We both looked younger than our years, and we started writing songs together. Right from the beginning, we sort of started to establish our songwriting partnership, even though I was sort of the lesser player, as it were, in the sort of nuts and bolts creative part, the craft part of it, I guess. And I was sort of the tweaker and the editor. And
yeah, in the songbook, you wrote, the question of who writes the songs was probably the most frequently asked and the most awkwardly answered.
Yeah, right.
Can you elaborate?
Well, part of it has to do with the fact that I think there are very few Romanowski and Phillips songs that weren't in some way contributed to by both of us, even though certainly there are plenty of songs that Ron Romanowski gets sole credit for writing. Even on those songs, there's always tweaking that I did and, you know, wrote or created most of the harmonies, if not all of them, pretty much all of them. But then on other songs, like, sometimes we would collaborate on the lyrics, but not the music. Sometimes we'd collaborate on the music, but not the lyrics. And we kind of had this sort of unwritten rule or code or whatever that it had to seem as if, at least, that we had both contributed pretty equally to either the lyrics or the music to get a credit for that, a songwriting credit for that on an album and stuff like that. And then the copyright information and stuff. But it was a much more organic process than simply Ron wrote a song or I wrote a song or we wrote a song.
Did you do more arranging or?
I definitely was more of the arranger, even on songs that I didn't have any songwriting credit on. That's always been sort of one of my strong points.
So you take the credit for the songs coming out in so many different styles?
To some degree, but then again, Ron wrote in those styles. I mean, one of the things that happened early on when we were writing a lot of comedy songs, funny songs, is that if you take a lyric and, you know, it's a funny lyric, but then you put it in a really sort of straightforward pop rock sensibility kind of musical style, it's not going to be that funny or as funny as if you put it in a style which lends itself to the feeling of humor, you know? So, like a song like Don't Use Your Penis for a Brain, it made sense for it to be Calypso. And I think that in many cases, if Ron was writing a song all by himself, he would definitely already have a style in mind. But like a lot of times, I would do things like add chords and chord changes to make the music more complex. Not that our music was ever that complex, but to make it richer. I don't think of us as incredibly complex songwriters. I never have and never will. The reality is we're pretty straightforward in all the stuff that we've written, I think. Yeah.
This is kind of a two-part question. So how would you compare the writing of the humorous songs to the serious songs?
The writing process?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, that even depended, again, on the circumstances. Each song was its own labor of love, and there were times when we definitely wrote, for sure, with our audience in mind, but we tried to avoid just writing to placate the audience. That was something that we really, really, really wanted to avoid. We didn't want to pander by any means, and we didn't want to write a song just because we thought people would want to hear it. You know, we wanted to write stuff that actually meant something to us, even if it was funny stuff. So I guess to answer the question about the songwriting for the funny songs, a lot of times we would just go back and forth trying to think of, like, some of our songs that are funny are more list songs, you know, a list of whatever, things that fit into a category that we were writing about or whatever. And sometimes that was just a matter of tossing things out. And
which were harder to write, the humorous ones or the serious ones?
Oh, boy. Jeez, I never thought about it at the time. To be honest with you, I never thought, oh, this was hard to write, this was easy to write. Some of them flowed like water out of Ron, especially. And then later in our career, I really had gotten more confidence in my own ability to write. So I was taking the initiative sometimes in writing stuff. Certainly, the songs that we wrote for the off-Broadway show that we did, wrote the songs for Jason.
Jason?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When we were working on Jason, I was probably more an active songwriting person then than ever. And then we wrote some songs for another musical.
Oh, Jackie.
For Oh, Jackie, correct. And in that one, there are actually several songs that I, or at least two songs that I wrote totally by myself without real input from Ron until they were done, until they were written anyway. But in the earlier times, it was definitely Ron who was the lead songwriter, for sure. And he used to say that songs, the good songs came through him, and I definitely got that sense. I mean, there were songs that just poured out of him, you know, that were written in an hour. There were other songs that were tweaked and pulled and nurtured and nudged and shoved out of the womb, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember which is which even. He probably would know more than I would. He has a better memory for those kinds of minutiae, as it were. But I do know that the pressure to be funny and to be clever was definitely something we felt from time to time. On the other hand, there was a different kind of pressure when you're writing a serious song like Living with AIDS or Lullaby, where the pressure was to say something in a creative way that did justice to the subject at hand without
trivializing it
without being cliche, you know, without saying the same thing that everybody else has already said, you know, all those things. There's a lot of pressure there. I can remember so much discussion about the song Living with AIDS. After it was written, we actually changed the way we sang it, one of the lines. There's one line where it's, and he probably will because he's active still. He goes to the marches and all the parades. And that was first written as, maybe he will. And then it was changed to, he probably will. And I think at one point we actually talked about that we still felt like that wasn't strong enough, wasn't mm-hmm. positive enough. I mean, it's bizarre how much we obsess sometimes on just two words.
Oh, that's a distinct difference, not change.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's funny how incredibly detailed we were. It's something that I think people don't think about or don't realize. And I also think that that's something that doesn't always occur in a lot of music, and certainly in a lot of pop music. I used to get so frustrated listening to so many pop artists sing these songs that I always felt could have been great, but were less than great because they were underwritten.
Mm-hmm.
And Ron used to always say, yeah, well, they don't have you around. And what he meant by that was that he used to say, he writes the songs and I make them better. And that was certainly an oversimplification, but I think there was some truth to it. And I don't say that because of my ego. I say that because I think when two people are involved in that creative process, it can only improve it. And I think there are a lot of songwriters out there who have great hooks, who have great ideas for songs, and they sort of flesh them out, but they don't go far enough with them. And that's what he used to say. That's why he used to say that, yeah, they don't have you around. They need one of you.
Well, he had some very, very positive, glowing things to say about your additions to the collaboration process.
That's really sweet to hear, and he tells me too. And it's something we both understand and know about each other. The fact is, no matter how great he may or may not think my additions are and my tweaking was and stuff, the reality is I couldn't tweak if there wasn't already some great stuff there. And so I will always be forever indebted to him for giving me that opportunity.
Tell me about that first cassette.
Oh, God. The one we're embarrassed to admit that we did?
Yeah, that one.
You mean in the outfield?
Mm-hmm.
What do you want to know about it?
How did you come about doing it?
You know, it's so vague in my memories. I think it was recorded live at the Valencia Rose. I could be wrong. I think it was recorded by possibly our friend Larry Good. That was way before I even had any clue as to what recording was about. It's the poorest of quality, and I haven't listened to it in forever. But I gotta say, it was all part and parcel of building towards something better. So I can't say that I'm embarrassed about it, really. I mean, you know, it's not something I'm excessively proud of. At the time, I was, only because it got us to the next level,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, there's three songs that were not recorded later, and one of them I thought really should have been, and that's Tell the Children.
Uh-huh. You know, you are not the first person to say that. Many, many people have said that over the years. And to be honest with you, we considered it, I believe, on several occasions. There was something wonderful about that song. I loved it. I thought it was a beautiful little song. The other side of it is that we got some criticism, even in the early days, about that song being a little on the didactic side, being a little on the preachy side, and certainly being a little on the, you know, I guess some people criticize the saying, don't tell me what to tell the children kind of thing, you know, or something like that. I don't know. I think it was maybe a little didactic, a little heavy-handed.
Okay, your first album came along.
Yeah. I thought you'd be taller. What can I say? That was the most absurdly produced album in the history of record making, I think. We didn't know what we were doing. I read a book while Ron was working at a law office, and we went in and made an album. It was one of the most incredible acts of love that's ever gone out there, I think.
What's the highlight for you from that album?
I think the highlight probably for me was the fact that I got to sing with myself for the first time in my life. That's one of the joys of the recording studio, is that you can actually do things like harmonize with yourself. And that was the birth of the Phillips Sisters on Womb Envy. And it was so bizarre. I mean, I don't know if Ron even told you about some of what happened in the studio. When I said that about it being a rather bizarre way of making an album, that was before digital. That was before, I mean, that was almost pre-analog. I mean, it was so old in terms of where recording is now, you know. And I can remember one of the songs on that album has like, oh, I don't know, it's like a 2.5-minute song with 27 splices or something like that. You know, some absurd combination of numbers there. And we actually would splice back and forth between different takes. That was how we edited back then.
Just to get a natural sound, right?
Yeah, right. But the weird thing is you can't tell that song was that incredibly edited. You really can't. I can't.
And then Teresa Trall came along.
And then Teresa Trall. God bless Teresa Trall. Amazing woman. Amazing woman with amazing connections. Took us to a whole new place. It was an absolutely stunning experience in the studio with her. It was also one of the most terrifying times for us because we went from being in total control, even though we didn't know what we were doing, but being able to say yes, no, you know. And why? Because I don't like it that way. And so the changes could be made. And then we went into the studio with Teresa Trull, who, I might add, does have her share of opinions and is not afraid to voice them. And God bless her for it, because she created one of our most popular albums. Excuse me, one of our most popular albums to date.
That's Trouble in Paradise.
Trouble in Paradise, right. I mean, it was an amazing thing working with her in the studio. She brought in so many incredible musicians that we would never have been able to go near were it not for her. It was a labor of love on her part, I'm sure. It was the perfect timing for something like that in both of our careers. Teresa had just sort of started into the producing field and had gotten her feet wet a little bit, but hadn't really done a whole lot. It was just really good timing that we were there to be one of her projects. I mean, she had been familiar with studios, you know, and had produced other albums. I'm not saying she hadn't, but I don't know. I think where it was at, it was just the perfect marriage.
What's your favorite memory of that album?
Oh, boy. My favorite memory of that album, I think, or probably my most vivid memory of that album, was Vicki Randall coming to me after I had recorded the vocals for my solo song to myself, and having Vicki Randall walk up to me and say, "You have such a sweet voice." I know that sounds really stupid, but that would be one of my biggest memories, and certainly one of my strongest memories, because she said it in a way that was convincing, that was not about flattery. It was coming from a place
of admiration.
Of admiration, and this is a woman who was already quite a professional, you know, had already played in bands, traveling, touring with some pretty big name people by then.
And what's her job now?
And now she's the percussionist on the Tonight Show band, with Jay Leno every night. And it's bizarre to see her there every night. Not that I see it every night, but every time I turn on Jay Leno, I crack up thinking, what, and that gal? It was so much fun. There was so much laughter. It was hard. I think it was much more difficult for Ron than it was for me.
Giving up control?
Yeah, definitely. He had never been able... I mean, he and I had our little battles over songs, but then... You know, we would solve them and whatever. But, yeah, I mean, and if I had it to do over again, I would stand up for a few things and make them different. Because as much as I love that album, there are aspects of it that I wish had been done differently. Because I don't think that they captured the Romanofsky and Phillips harmony thing as well as they could have. Like, I must have been drunk. I would never have had three backup singers and one lead. You know, I just wouldn't do it that way. Because that's not who we are. We're not soloists with backup singers. We're a duo. And I would make stuff like that happen a little differently.
That's probably the best song you could have picked. It sounds like an R&B song.
That sounds like an R&B song?
Yeah.
Well, everything about it sounds R&P, and the reality is, A, it's not an R&P song. That's one of the... I think that's the only song we ever recorded that somebody else wrote.
Yes, I think that's true.
And...
Written by Larry Havlock.
Right. Larry Havlock. Boy, there's someone from the past, too. Larry Havlock was a great singer-songwriter who... never got his real due, I don't think, out of Minneapolis. Wrote just a number of great, great songs. At least one other one I actually performed on stage several times.
So from Teresa Troll, 2 years later, you went back to doing it your own way.
Yeah, well, I just want to say about that Teresa Troll thing, just to go back, sorry, because I don't want it to end with me sounding sort of negative or like I would have done it differently, because the reality is I still love the album, and I think it's one of our best, but it does have a different feel. It's got a lot more other voices on it than any of our other albums. And I think for what we did, for what we had to work with, and for what she was able to contribute to it, I think it turned into a great project. I don't know that I would do it differently. I think I would probably try and figure out a way to have it be a little more duo-sounding on some of those songs.
So that's what you were after on the next album?
Yeah, exactly. That's it, exactly. When we went into the next album, we definitely wanted it to be a duo-type album. We wanted to make sure that it wasn't an album filled with solos by each of us, leads by each of us or whatever, without as much of our harmony work. Because I'm pretty proud of the harmony work that we've done.
And this was Emotional Roller Coaster.
Emotional Roller Coaster, that's right. Emotional Roller Coaster, and what was it?
The album?
Our personal lives as well. More, even more our personal lives, I think.
I think I wrote a comment that several of your songs came true.
Oh, yeah. That's a common thread throughout our whole career.
So what happened to get you from Emotional Roller Coaster to Be Political, Not Polite?
Well, with the next album, I had achieved full confidence. So I wasn't as willing to bring in somebody who was going to just sort of take the production away from me and steamroll it in whatever direction they wanted. Be Political was sort of my idea of an album that started to show some maturity as songwriters. I wanted it to sound more like a studio album again. I wanted to have more artistic control, which I did because we hired somebody who really wasn't a seasoned producer of anything other than his own albums, and maybe a few of the Holly Near stuff I think he got some production credits on. But I love John, and I love working with John.
John Bacchino.
Mm-hmm. Yes, John Bacchino. He is one of the most brilliant songwriters I've ever known. I believe he's appreciated, but not nearly as much as he should be.
And his piano work on some of Holly's albums is just wonderful.
Oh, well, as a pianist, he's totally, totally incredible. But as a songwriter, he's a songwriter's songwriter. He's an artist as a songwriter. And you can't really say that about a lot of people. A lot of songwriters are craftspeople. But John is so creative. Be Political was really the album that I started really, really developing my arranging abilities on. It was added to in no small part by, or improved upon in no small part by John's work with me. I think John and I tended to have the same sort of visions about some of the songs, and I'm very proud of Be Political, Not Polite.
And you had some wonderful guest vocalists.
Oh, well, that was a treat in and of itself. Yeah, I mean, what singer in our ilk, at least, would not be pretty thrilled to have Michael Callan, Holly Near, Frank, and Alex Dobkin all singing on the same album?
Tell me about Michael Callan working on the song Him.
That song was so amazing because we originally, I mean, the intention was to bring in a choir or bring in four or five people and have them all lay down a bunch of different vocals and then blend it all together. And we brought Michael in, and he was actually, he was feeling a little sick during that period, I think. I mean, he wasn't looking really healthy. But, you know, he came in and he said, sure, I'll sing. And we played him the line that we wanted him to sing on. And I don't know, it just kind of snowballed. We said, okay, well, you want to try the other one? And next thing you know, he had laid down all these different tracks and created an entire boys' choir. And it was absolutely stunning to watch him sing. I mean, it was like watching poetry. I mean, it really was.
And yeah. Then Holly, Alex, and Frank on No False Hope.
Yeah, that was fun. That was just plain fun. That's all that was. it kind of all happened spur of the moment, kind of, as I recall, and we really hadn't even planned it out. That was one of those things that just kind of happens in the studio where you don't even know exactly what you want to hear. You kind of have this idea, but you just kind of say, okay, you sing this note, and now you try singing this note. And it was funny because, like Frank didn't have a very high voice, and so we couldn't really have, like, a girl's choir sound or anything like that. And Alice's voice isn't particularly high, soprano. I just remember John sitting there going, try this note. eventually we got it to all work. But we had fun doing it. It was such a labor of love.
So then there was a Ron's solo album and then your sort of greatest hits album, Brave Boys.
Right. Well, and Ron's solo album was a period where, as difficult as it was, there was a conscious effort made for me to stay out of the picture. It was an important time for him. It was something he really did need to do for many reasons, personal, artistic, whatever. And I needed to find something to do with my time while that was happening. Sort of by a chance of kismet, I ended up sort of having my own project that happened not exactly at the same time, but in that same period. And that was the Joe Bracco project.
So Brave Boys was a greatest hits with several re-recordings.
The Brave Boys album and the Let's Flaunt It album were really two albums that were planned at the same time. The Greatest Hits album actually has a couple of tracks from the live concerts that were recorded for Let's Flaunt It. But we kind of felt like it was about time for that. I don't know if it was or not.
Yeah, I think so.
But we were getting a lot of requests for that kind of thing. And, you know, I'll tell you, Brave Boys is both a joy and a blessing and a tiny bit of a curse, I think, for us, because we were at that stage in our career where we were trying to figure out how to make the next step up the ladder. And we hired somebody to do a lot of radio promotion for us for Brave Boys. We released a little 3-song mini CD kind of thing, for a demo CD to send to radio stations that were from the Brave Boys album. And I don't know if we made the right choices. And frankly, I don't care whether they were right or wrong at this point. It doesn't really matter. But I will say that it's at times almost laughable to me to listen to the version of Homophobia that's on that, on the Brave Boys CD. Sometimes I sit there and think, what in the world were we thinking? Because it so is not our style. I think that we were trying to find a way to make that song feel and sound more contemporary.
Reach a different market, maybe?
Well, I guess there was something to that, although I'd hate to think that that's why we did it, was just to reach a new market. We were doing a lot more college circuit gigs at that point. I think it had as much to do with wanting to do something different for ourselves as it was for, oh, we're going to get into a new market with this. I really do. I mean, yes, that was there. But there are lengths to which I would not have gone just to reach a new audience. I'm willing to prostitute myself to a degree, but not at the expense of my own integrity, I don't think. And when we were doing that particular song, I remember just getting very excited about it because it felt new, it felt relevant, it felt like hip and cool and different. As soon as it actually came out, I realized that not a lot of people were going to be able to buy it, you know. And when I say buy it, I mean all of our old fans, I think, probably when they put that on, just kind of went, what? And if there were new fans who were buying that album for the first time, I think once they got past that song, if they liked that song, would then have gone, what, to the rest of the album.
It was just too different.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm proud that we tried it. I really am. And I think it's perfectly fitting that it's on an album called Brave Boys. Because I think we were brave, not just in terms of our career and being as out as we were and stuff like that, which was certainly a brave thing. Certainly at the time we started, it was a brave thing. But I think we ultimately were brave enough not to really care too much what people thought about us, you know? I mean, that's still the way I live my life. If somebody doesn't like what I'm doing, well, that's their stuff, not mine, you know?
Well, let's get to Let's Flaunt It. What's your strongest memory of that album?
Oh, boy. Strongest memory of the album. I'm trying to remember it because it was a very different album to make because there was no... Can we try that again?
Mm-hmm.
We recorded 3 concerts and hoped for the best. And I think we got a pretty good album out of it all. I really think that Let's Flaunt It shows us at our live best. There were parts of it. There were some studio overdubs that we did, you know, just to sort of fluff it out a little bit. But for the most part, what you hear is exactly what the audience got. The problem with that actually is that at the same time as we recorded it for releasing a CD, we also recorded all of them on videotape. And unfortunately, the money ran out before we were ever able to release a live video.
That is a shame.
Which I think could have made a difference in our career, perhaps.